Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, the battle for TV news hots up as Rupert Murdoch takes on Andrew Neil. Facebook announces a big payday for UK news publishers, but is it too little, too late? Plus, we find out why prison radio is the darling of the awards season, what needs to be done to tackle disability discrimination in our industry, and in the media quiz, you'll find out that I'm not the most gifted mimic. It's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And joining me today, another crack team of media insiders. First up, writer, producer, director, Deborah Coughlin's back on the show. Hello, Deborah.
Hi, Ollie. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, all the better for seeing you. It's been basically a year. You were just launching Wakey when we last had you on the show, which is kind of like a breakfast TV show for your mobile, isn't it? With an emphasis on improving mental well-being. I think it's fair to say the mental health of the nation has needed some improving since then. How has 2020 played out for you?
Oh, wow. Okay, well, what a time to launch a mental health edutainment app that helps you get up in the morning when basically everybody stops getting up in the morning and needs loads of help with their mental health. We've had a fascinating year. We did a study, a 12-week feasibility study with guys in St. Thomas on the impact and effectiveness of Wakey, and it turned out that Wakey worked. It helped people have happier, healthier lives, which is great. And we're now about to go, we've just launched version 2 of the app, which has all kinds of new spangly interactive ways of looking after your mental health on it, and extra content in there above and beyond the breakfast show. And now going into the new year, we're going to be launching a whole load of new shows. So yeah, it's a very exciting time. It's a shame that it happened during a global pandemic.
And also, like, in media business terms, obviously this year we've had the high profile collapse of Quibi. I mean, did that make you think twice about mobile video model as your model? I guess what's different for you is it wakes you up rather than something you take on your commute. But
yeah, I think Quibi had a few issues. I mean, you know, they didn't make very much of their own content, so there wasn't that easy to sell it on and go to a plan B. But also, they I remember reading, I can't remember who it was who did a kind of review of Quibi, saying Quibi seems to be lacking purpose. And if there's anything that Wakey doesn't lack, it's purpose. So, we're purpose-driven. Quibi, sadly, was not.
RIP. Also joining us, MediaPod stalwart and chief content officer of production company Something Else, Mr. Steve Ackerman. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Ollie.
It is that time of the year when all audio production companies like to flout their award successes and all the selections they've had in the best of podcast list this year. So go on then. Here's a minute of airtime. Go for it. Tell us what Something Else has done.
Well, the two shows that are in Apple's best of podcast selection are How Do We Get Here, which is the Claudia Winkleman sort of wellbeing show, and the show we've just had out with David Dimbleby, The Fault Line, Bush, Blur and Iraq, which is really superb if you want a dissection of, doesn't look at the actual war itself, it looks at the run-up to the war. So particularly proud of those, but obviously shows like David Tennant and An Out to Lunch with Jay Rayner and Something Rhymes with Purple have all continued to just go from strength to strength. So yeah, all good.
There you are, you filled the minute perfectly. And next to Steve on my screen is the return of writer and journalist Caroline Crampton. Hello, Caroline.
Hello, Ollie.
You write a regular column for Hot Pod, which is the podcast industry's international newsletter. And this week I saw you were delving into the podcast designed as sleep aids. So the opposite of what Deborah is making. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, so I've actually done this as a sort of two-part thing. I wrote at first about Headspace, Calm, those apps that, you know, give you sleep stories, sleep podcasts, like Sleep With Me, that kind of thing. And then more recently, I wrote about a new BBC Sounds podcast called The Sink, which is parodying those podcasts, but actually it's kind of a horror fiction show. The producer summed it up to me as the Help to Sleep tape that's out to get you. And that's, I think,
how marvellous that the BBC
summation.
Can do something quite as niche as that. I mean, a pastiche of an app that itself is filtered through a subcultural reference.
Yeah, it's also got a very culty comedy feel to it. If you like something like The League of Gentlemen, say, I think this is, it's that kind of humour.
Okay, well, if you're listening to this podcast today to help you sleep, good luck with that. We've got a lot going on. Supremely energising offer for you this week. Let's kick off with this. The shit hot world of 24-hour TV news. We have not entered a time warp. It's not the 90s. But a new battle is on the cards as a Murdoch-backed station, News UK TV, looks set to beat the much-hyped GB News and launch first next year. Steve, execs at both of these networks obviously believe there is a right-of-centre audience disillusioned with the BBC who will come to their offering. Are they right?
Well, I think they are right. We know obviously from social media activity, you can see there is an audience for that voice. You've only got to look at the COVID demonstrations or some of the other things that have happened across the past year to see that for a certain type of person, there is great distrust amongst what they would describe as the mainstream media. I wouldn't say I necessarily agree, but you know, you can see there is an audience for it.
Isn't it hilarious that if you're anti-mainstream media, you'd rely on Rupert Murdoch to make you a TV channel?
Yeah, but
I mean, who could be more firmly part of the establishment?
But Rupert Murdoch's fantastic sleight of hand has constantly been being able to position himself as anti the establishment, when of course a billionaire who owns, you know, huge swathes of the media all around the world and can walk into any prime minister or president's office is certainly not anti-establishment. But ultimately, the one thing you can say is if Rupert Murdoch's putting money behind it, you know, someone who's one of the most impressive media businessmen that we've ever seen, he's no fool. He clearly feels there's an opportunity there.
I mean, I said 24-hour news in my intro, Caroline, but actually that's not entirely right, is it?
No, I think it's going to be 24-hour in the sense that some other 24-hour stations are that, in that there'll be some repeats, there'll be some borrowing of content from other places. And I also think an important aspect of it will be, in the same way that we've seen Times Radio, another launch from Murdoch, I think it will be a funnel towards his other businesses. You know, Times Radio is great at selling Times subscriptions from all we've heard, and I think this may well end up being a similar thing.
Similar to what, though? I mean, what are they shilling? The Sun?
The Sun, the Times, other subscription packages, I guess. There's been some talk of bundling, but that's always been an interesting aspect, hasn't it? That Murdoch owns The Sun, but he also owns The Times, and those, you imagine those two audiences are quite distinct.
Yeah, I'd imagine so, Deborah. I mean, I heard that one of the potential working titles for their evening show was going to be Gotcha, which is obviously a famous Sun headline. So it seems like that's the kind of audience they're going for, kind of blue-collar audience. And then that would line up with rumours that Rupert Murdoch's been seen wining and dining with Nigel Farage. I mean, he'd be the perfect host if he were going to do that every evening, wouldn't he? And he's available at the moment. Do you think there's a niche?
I don't know. I mean, the more we've been talking to our users who pretty much, you know, kind of tend to be key workers and hourly paid workers and gig economy. All of them told us during lockdown, please don't talk about the news. We're fed up with news. We don't want to hear the C word, the corona COVID word. We can't take more news. I've been avoiding news like the plague recently. I find it quite depressing. So I find it quite shocking at the moment that there are two new potential channels coming when I can barely deal with what we've got at the moment and Twitter. I'm not quite sure where they're going to fit in. They must have a lot of market research that tells them this is a great idea. I personally can't believe that there's enough need out there for it or desire.
I think we can all agree it's a shit name though, can't we, Steve? News UK TV. That's no one's favourite TV channel.
Well, I'm sure that's not what the eventual title is going to be. And I wonder when you think of what News UK are doing in terms of obviously the investments they've made into radio and audio and obviously the launch of Times Radio. I know what we've just been discussing is how this station definitely probably isn't positioned for the Times market. But I would be interested to see whether they try and utilise The Sun as a brand in this space. You know, one would think that, you know, certainly that seems to be the thinking that's going on of starting to run their brands in a number of different places. And so obviously, if you're running a news TV operation, I think that's a possibility. Just one other thing in terms of the point Deborah was just making about, you know, she's not sure if there's demand. If you go back in the history books, the same arguments were made in the US at the launch of Fox News. And, you know, people were very, very dismissive of what Fox was going to be about and felt there wasn't any demand for it. And, you know, depending on your point of view, my point of view, sadly, we've all been proven wrong. And Fox, as you know, has ended up being a massive money spinner.
Although that is a cable TV audience in the States, isn't it, which is older. I mean, what's quite interesting about this is it seems to be an online first operation, which normally skews younger. Do you think, Caroline, there's enough of that kind of anti-mainstream media, whatever you call it, maybe softly alt-right audience, that's that age in this country? And basically, you know, let's say, I don't know, 35 to 50 to be watching this rather than 50 plus.
I think this is a Facebook audience. I think if you think how popular these kind of topics, this kind of spectrum of politics is on Facebook, I think that's the appeal of this. And I also think that maybe this isn't exactly news. This is like news as edutainment. You might be wanting to avoid sort of proper news, we might call BBC headlines about how coronavirus is going, but you might want to tune into something that confirms what you already think about things.
And I'm just curious about the Murdoch element of this. I mean, the man is nearly 90 years old. Steve, the first words of Jim Waterson's piece in The Guardian about this were Rupert Murdoch, you know, as in Rupert Murdoch's forthcoming opinionated news channel, da-di-da-di-da. To what extent do you think the great man himself is personally involved here? I mean, what has he got to prove? He's been selling everything off. Why would he want to start building it up again?
Well, that isn't necessarily true. They've been selling everything off. Back to the radio point, really. There's been huge investment from that business into audio. And, you know, funnily enough, into radio at a time when many other radio groups are struggling or when there's been great consolidation in the industry. What I think you have seen is obviously what's been sold off is the entertainment bits, and what's been retained and amplified even more are bits around news and information. And we all know news is power. And if you apply the old model, in the old model, it was buy a newspaper because that can give you access. Maybe the thinking is, again, looking at the American model and looking at how Fox, obviously over the past 4 years, has been hugely influential, maybe the thinking is, well, actually, the way to do it these days is not necessarily through newspapers, it's through TV and radio.
All right, staying with news, we also learnt this week that Facebook is going to be bringing their curated news service to the UK, and a sizable amount of money with it as well, Deborah. What have they announced?
They are doing a deal with mainstream outlets in the UK. So they're going to be buying up news stories from some of the biggest media companies in the UK. I can't quite understand why. I've been reading the article that you guys sent over in advance, and I was like, why are they doing this? I don't quite understand. Do you?
Caroline.
Why are Facebook doing it?
Yeah. And fear of regulation seems like an obvious one.
Yeah, I think definitely fear of regulation. I think working with kind of so-called mainstream media organisations confers a sense of legitimacy, a sense that Facebook is, you know, a trustworthy partner in the media rather than an enemy, which is how I think a lot of publishers have perhaps rightly traditionally seen it. So I think deals up front like that help things stay in business rather than seeming like an oppositional move.
But the thing is, Steve, Facebook is social. I mean, that is their thing. That's what they invented, right? And yet, this isn't going to be a social news feed. This is going to be curated by contractors, a bit like Twitter Moments, or I suppose, you know, in the old world, a bit like The Week magazine. You know, they're going to have people sort of independently saying, oh, these are the news stories we think you should look at. That's not what Facebook do. Like, Facebook is where you go for your friends to tell you what to look at. If they want to reward the news companies, why not give them a slice of that?
Well, I think Facebook is where you go to see what your friends are looking at, or friends are telling you what to look at, was maybe where Facebook was. I don't think that necessarily is true now. I mean, you only, again, have to look at the spread of conspiracy theories and you know, Pizzagate and some of the more sort of, you know, QAnon, some of the more crackpot things to see that, again, information and seeking out information has become a key focal point of part of what Facebook does. And obviously, as we know, there are huge swathes people who only get their news or information from a social media source. They don't read a newspaper, or they don't go to a news website, or they don't even turn on the TV to watch news. And so in that sense, if you're Facebook, I think this feels like a pretty natural step. I mean, of course, I'm sure, you know, I completely agree with Caroline. It's completely driven, I'm sure, by trying to head off regulation at the pass. You know, you always see this with Facebook. As soon as politicians start trying to make noises about they're going to make things tougher for Facebook, Facebook takes some sort of initiative to try and head it off at the pass. And both in the US and here, those are the noises that are rumbling at the moment.
I suppose the change might be, if you're a news organisation, Caroline, is you start writing a different kind of article if you want it to get selected into the Facebook news feed. And we should say this exists in the United States already, doesn't it? And has been operating quite successfully there. I wonder if you start writing a more rigorously researched, slightly more intelligent article than the kind of article you write to get clicks from people's mates. And so Facebook might see this as their contribution to writing some of the wrongs that they've done in terms of the algorithms.
I think there's probably something to that. Yeah, I think news organisations these days will sadly do anything to get chosen for the front page of whatever. I've seen this when I used to run the website for the New Statesman, and Apple News and the homepage on Samsung phones was a massive driver of traffic. Anything we could do that would appeal to the people who curated that, you know, could do wonders for your stats that month. So yeah, I think it's quite possible that people will start doing whatever it is Facebook will prioritize, if that turns out to be a more seriously toned, less seemingly clickbaity thing. Then yeah, I'm sure Facebook will put that in the shareholders report.
And did you see at the New Statesman people then actually becoming regular readers or even subscribers as a result of coming through Apple News? Because that's the thing, isn't it? You might get some new readers, but they're not interested in your brand. They're interested in the headline.
It was really hard to track, to be honest, because only part of it happens on your platform and, you know, part of it happens on Apple's. But that's what we were told the purpose of opting into that was. I think we definitely saw some writers attracting more fans. You know, we would see them get followers, you know, see them sign up for a newsletter that person wrote or something. Whether it contributed to the sort of long-term model of the magazine, I can't say.
And Deborah, there's kind of a patchwork of these kinds of features on Facebook, aren't there now, which just kind of exist. And of course, they're huge in their own ways because it's Facebook and it's one of the biggest web services in the world. But real people in the real world don't ever seem to talk about them. I'm thinking about the original shows on Facebook Watch, for example. I mean, they're there. There's a tab. I can click it. I've never heard anyone actually talk about it.
No, I think probably one of the biggest features I do know people actually use is the marketplace. So there is a kind of like Facebook, eBay, which people do use. But in the end, when it comes to content, I think on Facebook, it's still going to be the kind of craziest headline is going to be the thing that draws people in. And also once you get into doom scrolling, I think most people just doom scroll on Facebook now. You go into one video, and the thing that's addictive about it is constantly being served up new videos one after the other within, you know, seconds, not even minutes. So this is all very nice. But these brands, these news brands, unless they can compete with that, I don't quite see how this is going to become anything big on Facebook particularly.
Do you know, that's an interesting comparison, though. Final point on this, but Facebook Marketplace, that is something that makes me feel a bit warmer and cuddlier towards Facebook as a brand, because they help me sell for cash stuff that I've got around my house. I wonder if that's all this is, really. They're just throwing The Guardian and, you know, Reach and whoever else has signed up for this, you know, just a few shekels to say, look, you feel a bit better now, don't you? You feel a bit better about people looking at your stories on Facebook.
It does feel like a pity move in a way. I mean, like, they don't need to do it. So if they are doing it for regulation, that makes a lot of sense. But otherwise, all these brands were already advertising on Facebook and you know, spending a huge amount of money on there. So this is, let's see if it's still there in a year.
Okay, finally for this part, let's talk about Channel 4. They've announced a new 5-year digital first strategy. So it's like America First, but it'll last 1 year longer. Steve, there's a few points here that have been helpfully summarised by The Drum. What caught your eye?
Well, I suppose a couple of elements. I mean, first of all, the sort of very public aim to switch or to move, you know, a much more significant chunk of their revenues away from the traditional terrestrial TV model, which clearly makes sense. I mean, you know, for someone like Channel 4, that's got to be of concern. And I think ITV have made obviously similar noises as well. The other thing that caught my eye was the announcement that they were going to, they'd set up, I think it was a £50 million fund in terms of investing into content. And the reason it caught my eye is because, sadly, in the world we're currently in, that's actually a pretty small amount of money. When you think that, I think it was only this week, Netflix announced that they'll spend $1 billion in the UK over the next, I think, year or couple of years, but certainly, you know, £1 billion spend coming. You can see the context of 50 million is really nice and obviously buys you quite a lot of TV shows, and, you know, will be very welcomed, I'm sure, by the producers who end up receiving some of that money. But in the battle Channel 4 is in, which is against these global giants, it's a really tough battle, I think. One other thing actually that I think is smart is that they seem to be honing in, you know, having a much greater focus on a younger audience, and really trying to play on, obviously, the sort of brand they've built through 3E4. And I think whichever audience you're going for, I think the one thing that that broadcasters such as Channel 4 have to do now is have a really clear sense of who it is that they're targeting, because of the fact that the Netflixes and Amazon Primes of this world can target just anything and everyone.
But there's still the legacy, isn't there, Deborah, of the people who actually watch the terrestrial channel, which, of course, aren't the same people. And that's the confusion, isn't it? So they've launched this brand purpose, which is represent unheard voices, challenge with purpose, reinvent entertainment. I mean, all exactly the sort of thing you'd expect Channel 4 to say that they want to do. But the truth is, if you look at their schedule on the TV station, which still makes up a lot of their revenue, there's still an awful lot of country houses and makeover shows and crafts. And that's because that's what that older audience like. I mean, how do they cross that circle?
Well, I think this is a really exciting move. I think this is exactly what they should be doing. I mean, the Steph Show, I think, says a lot. The fact that the Steph Show had, I think, recorded zero viewers 1 week, which is pretty bad in the midst of lockdown, showed that they're not in sync with that kind of like younger audience. They can't drag them to that platform, but also they're not providing what that older audience wants either. I mean, they can't ever really get rid of location, location, location and grand designs, because otherwise I don't know what I'd watch. But I think this is exactly what they should be doing. They should be, and it is a small amount of money compared to Netflix. And, you know, conversely, Netflix is meant to be going into linear TV very soon, so we'll be competing with them for that kind of daytime audience. But there's they should be spending money on young talented creatives in the UK, making content that only young talented creatives in the UK could make for people in the UK, and really that should be their niche. And in the end, they're just going to have to, maybe they'll kind of abandon ship on the linear channel, I would imagine. But I think this is very exciting, exactly what they should be doing.
I mean, actually, they are tremendously successful on all four. 34 million registered subscribers. They've had 1 billion streams this year. I don't know about you, Caroline. I mean, I personally don't rate the experience of using it. I mean, maybe that just goes to show that if you've got the content, it doesn't really matter.
I was just going to say that's the one thing I come away from all of this thinking about, is all of the times I've been trying to watch Bake Off on all four and I just get the same ad served to me 10 times because it gets stuck in a loop on the app and I can't get out of it because it's an ad and you can't cancel it. Yeah, so I feel like some of the money should maybe go on improving that experience if it's all heading in that direction.
Which, of course, is something they can't say, Steve. You know, we're going to put money into technology because that's just not cool.
Well, you have to put it in to some degree, don't you? And that's the difficult thing for a platform like Channel 4. You know, limited income, and yet they've got to be able to invest in some of those areas, because obviously, as you know, as everyone else has been saying, those are where the audiences are now headed.
The other thing they can't say, it seems to me, is that they're lining up these priorities. They're saying they want 10% of their total revenue to come from non-advertising sources over the next 5 years, like you said. So that's about 100 million quid. And the obvious way to do that is to do what ITV's been saying they're doing, which is to make more stuff in-house. But it's Channel 4, and their whole raison d'etre is supporting the independent production sector. So that's a problem as well, isn't it? Most of what they're trying to achieve would actually be easier if they made more of their own stuff and stopped supporting indies. But they're there to support indies.
Well, not necessarily, only because obviously any show they are funding, they will still have a rights position in. So if the show does well and sells internationally, then obviously Channel 4 are going to benefit from that. And that's part of obviously...
But they have a stake, but they don't own it.
they have a state, but they don't own it. But ownership obviously comes with its own problems, including a much greater increase in overheads, an ability to, or maybe a difficulty in being able to move quite as quickly. You know, look at the issues the BBC has had and BBC Studios have had in terms of trying to straddle between being, you know, trying to have the mentality of an independent producer, but really being part of a much bigger entity. You know, those things don't necessarily come hand in hand. I'm not sure it's necessarily a magic wand. You know, if it was a magic wand, then you'd say, well, why aren't studios like Netflix making everything in-house, when obviously they're not either? They outsource, you know, pretty much everything. So that's maybe the counterpoint.
And throughout the lifetime of this podcast, we've been tracking Channel 4's attempts to pacify politicians by regionalising. We're now at the solution where they have Bristol, Glasgow, Leeds, Manchester and some place called London. Has it made a difference? Have they communicated the difference that it's made?
I personally haven't noticed as a viewer. I don't know how much that matters, whether it's the back end, it's the, you know, where staff are located, where productions happen. But if they're looking for visible wins, I don't think they've made one in that regard.
I think it's probably more subtle than that. I mean, first of all, when you see obviously the relocation into some other cities and you know, places like Leeds, you know, felt that that was a really significant moment, Channel 4 choosing to relocate there. And we've obviously seen through the BBC in terms of Salford, it does have an impact, obviously, in terms of eventually you get to a point where instead of just shipping people up from London, you are employing local people. And that's got to have an impact eventually on the viewpoints and creativity that hopefully flow through to the screen. I mean, I think the regional thing is a slight red herring. It was, you know, something that obviously came from politicians. I think the much bigger issue,
it's
obviously,
sleight of hand almost. Isn't
well,
it?
It's well,
they kept London open.
I mean,
and then they've just done this to tick a box.
You know, I don't know about ticking a box because they have obviously put significant teams in these locations, particularly on the sales front. But I just think the bigger issue that we're all facing is obviously around diversity and inclusion and making sure that there's a proper reflection behind the mic or behind the screen and in front of it. And this does help that to some degree, you could argue. But I think a focus on regionality is a slight red herring and maybe chimes more with a government that's obviously got their levelling up agenda and feels that that's a way that they can win votes, rather than necessarily focuses on, I think, the more important issue of how we do ensure that the content that is created completely reflects the communities that it's created for.
OK, we'll have more chat about diversity in media and representation of people behind bars after this.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Media Podcast is made in partnership with Rethink Audio, a group of award-winning podcast producers. Let's have a quick turn of the dial and hear what they've been up to this week.
I had one patient I was speaking to, their son on the phone. She wouldn't have survived a ventilator, and it was right at the peak where we just didn't have very many.
TV doctor Alex George reveals what life is like in Lewisham Hospital during lockdown for The Waiting Room.
I'm a stand-up and I love making things and I love making jokes. I'm selfish as a creative. I like making it to my own brief.
What is comedian Joe Lycett grateful for? Angela Scanlon finds out in Thanks a Million.
Judy kind of had a bit of a girl crush on, a proper girl crush on Donnie, didn't you?
And Alex Jones joins Richard and Judy on the WH Smith's book club sofa.
I mean, what's an improper girl?
Well, you said you could imagine kissing her. Didn't you?
I did. Well, now we are going down a very different route.
And much, much more. Maybe they can help you make your next podcast. For more information, head to rethinkaudio.com now. Welcome back. Still with me, Caroline, Deborah and Steve. And Caroline, it's been a big couple of weeks for prison radio. It always is at awards season. But what have they done this time?
Well, the Prison Radio Association has had some absolutely outstanding results at the Audio Production Awards in particular, particularly taking home Production Company of the Year, a highly coveted position, and getting a few wins and nominations for specific producers and presenters as well. So, yeah, they've done really well. And I think it's been a very hard year for everybody. It's been a particularly hard year for people who make content in prisons when you can't go into prisons anymore. They've had to shift completely to working remotely, working with people who've been released from prison as opposed to being able to work with the actual people in prison. So I think they'll be very proud of that. And I think the rest of the audio community was rightly quite proud of them too.
I mean, Steve, you've judged a lot of these kinds of awards. What is the secret of the Prison Radio Association? Because I mean, I'm not taking this away from them. They're obviously brilliant, but it's almost become a cliche. Like, I mean, my wife, who does not work in audio, has sat next to me at numerous award ceremonies and predicts every time that they're nominated that they're going to win, and they always do. What is it about the Prison Radio Association? What's the secret sauce?
Well, they do produce brilliantly emotive award entries and actually really well-made programmes. I mean, ultimately, I've always found whenever you judge any of these awards, despite some of the criticisms that sometimes come from those those who aren't involved, it's actually a really rigorous process, and people take it really, really seriously and offer the respect to the entries that they deserve. And therefore, if you end up winning, it is because you really deserve it. And what you see with the Prison Radio entries is they often have an honesty and an emotion that I think particularly in radio, maybe less so in podcasting these days, but I think particularly in radio is very difficult to do because so much radio is obviously music-based radio. And even on the speech stations, they're sort of operating within particular straitjackets. I think it's only in podcasting you've started to see the same sort of approach coming through. And the other thing is obviously just they have always had a range of voices. And again, a range of voices that you often just don't hear in other places. I mean, the prisoner experience is a really unique one. So they are great entries, and they are always absolutely brilliant to listen to.
You mentioned podcasting. I mean, to further evidence this trend, at the Australian Podcast Awards a couple of weeks ago, it was a prison documentary series made by female inmates that won Podcast of the Year. Ear Hustle in the States, of course, was nominated for a Peabody. Deborah, do you share fascination with what goes on behind bars?
Not personally, but reading all these stories, I completely agree with Steve that one of the reasons for why content coming out of prison radio and prison podcasts would be so appealing and so moving is because of the context in which those shows are created and the audience for which they're created for. So no, it's not something that I'm particularly fascinated with, but I can understand why that context would result in excellent work.
Caroline, have you done a long read about why people love prison podcasts?
Coming on Tuesday, Ollie.
So, give us the highlights. What's the thesis?
Well, it goes back to intimacy, basically. I've just been speaking to someone from the Prison Radio Association earlier today for the piece, and he reminded me that in UK prisons, there's no access to the internet. So For instance, during the pandemic, the only way prisoners could really find out what the tiers system, the lockdown tier system, meant for them was on prison radio, which they listened to through their TVs in their cells. Just really basic, boring stuff that we just Google all the time has this sort of emotive story behind it. So yeah, I think that kind of intimacy of people being alone in a large group really works well for audio.
Maybe slightly for the rest of us as well, more of a sense of kind of big sympathy, I guess, with prisoners than perhaps there used to be. I mean, it's always been fashionable to kind of say, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." But actually, a lot of people would just think, "Well, I'd never end up in the nick, you know. That would never be me." It seems to me like, I mean, maybe podcasting is partly responsible for this, but it seems to me like the more stories you hear of people that are incarcerated, there is a temptation to think, "Oh, a few wrong decisions, and that could have been me."
A few wrong decisions, or you know, that kind of Kafka thing of being stuck inside a system that whichever way you turn, you're stonewalled. I think people are becoming a bit more aware of that with regards to the benefit system, for instance. And I think the prison system is analogous to that, really. So yeah, a few wrong decisions, a few, you know, appointments missed at the job centre or whatever. And yeah, maybe that could be some, you or someone you know.
Let's stick with radio for a bit. And Ofcom have published a new report on diversity in the industry and in the TV sector as well. Deborah, what did it say?
Well, it said that disabled people are underrepresented in TV and radio. And that's not really a surprise. I think representation, you know, having worked at the BBC, I can see that you know, media organisations continue to struggle to have good representation across all kinds of different parts of the population.
And struggle because why? Because, I mean, that's a very interesting example, isn't it? I mean, the BBC versus almost every other media company in the country are the company that have, you know, elevators, access, diversity programs, you know, scrupulously fair interview procedures. So how are they failing?
Well, I'm not singling them out. I'm just saying that it happens to be my experience.
No, but from your experience.
What?
I mean, it's sort of like if they can't make it work, then, you know, you can imagine why a smaller company would think, well, this is really a challenge.
Well, I think somebody wrote an article this week saying, well, you know, if white Oxbridge guys find it hard to, you know, get where they want in media, then imagine how everybody else feels. And it's just a highly competitive industry. So many people want to work in radio, podcast, TV. Too many people. I mean, how many production companies are there? And how few places are there to get jobs that are full-time, well-paid? It's just there's so much competition, and like all areas of life where there's competition, unfortunately, the obvious people find it easier to get through.
Caroline, it's true, isn't it, even today, that a lot of studios, for example, are in the basements of old buildings that you can't get into very easily. I mean, basic stuff like that, which is a challenge for disabled people and is moving very, very slowly.
Yeah, so all of the scrupulously fair interview procedures in the world won't help someone get into the BBC's Maida Vale studio if they've got to go down some stairs. So yeah, I think sometimes it's easier to put in place funding and initiatives and protocols than it is to think about like ramps and extra bathrooms and wider doors and things that on paper should be simpler, but maybe don't get included as much as they should.
And Steve, I mean, you're running a production company. What initiatives have you seen that actually help?
Well, I think that, again, this rolls into the wider question of enforcing change and making sure that it happens at a much quicker pace than it has done. You know, the truth is, for the entire industry, radio, TV, all forms of media, there's been lots of initiatives, there's been lots of good intentions, but there hasn't been enough aggression in how quickly things have changed. I think that is changing now. You know, I think you can see that. I mean, just today, I've noticed how Tim Davies announced the five-year targets now for, you know, the sort of rigid targets for his 50-20-12 plan. I think it's 50-20-12, isn't it? In terms of 50% female representation, 20% black and ethnic and Asian representation, and 12, I think, is disabled. I hope I've got those stats right. So you can see those things are now happening. I mean, actually, one really practical thing worth mentioning is just something last week that a colleague of mine has just started up. A chap called Darby Doris, who's one of our senior audio folks, he's just launched the Disabled People in Audio group, and he's trying to create a safe space at the moment just for disabled people to, you know, to congregate in and share their experiences and what they're going through, and obviously to start to discuss how they can push more for greater change and work with broadcasters and companies to effect change. So the place to find that group, it's actually a Facebook group. So my understanding is go on Facebook and type in disabled people in audio, and you should get there eventually. But my understanding is already he's got quite a lot of sign-ups, and that's something that he's looking for people, not just in the UK, because I know Ollie, this is an international show, also for people working in media internationally as well.
Brilliant. Okay. And Deborah, I mean, you're working in the field of mental health or adjacent to that. Mental health, you know, can be classified as a disability as well, can't it, in certain circumstances? And it's very in vogue, obviously, to talk to people that suffer from bad mental health to say, think about your concerns, think about how you can get to work, you know, don't feel like you're suppressed from applying for the job you want. But there's not much in the way of support for employers. I mean, I'm just thinking from the point of view of a small production company, if they're choosing between two candidates, one of whom says, I have such and such a mental health condition, the other one who doesn't, the employer might feel, well, it's going to be easier not to employ the person with the mental health condition. And in a way, they'd be right. I mean, if you know, there are challenges to supporting an employee who's differently abled in all sorts of ways. I appreciate we're talking about discrimination laws here, and there are laws to stop you doing this. I'm just saying the reality of how people actually think. What support is there for employers to help them structure their business around that kind of diversity? Because that has to be part of the conversation too, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it does. And that's tough, because I don't think the support really is there for employers to be able to cover, say, periods of time off work and things like that. But what I think is helpful about the kind of conversation around mental health at the moment is how many employers and people in power have openly admitted their own struggles with mental health. And also, when I was at the Radio 4 not that long ago, you know, we were all being trained in mental health first aid, which is just incredible. I couldn't even imagine that happening just a couple of years ago.
So does that come down to sometimes things as simple as what to say to someone who's experiencing a particular episode or going through a particular thing? Or is it more complex?
I think sometimes in terms of prevention of a crisis, if somebody feels they're able to talk to you early on, then you're more likely to prevent that crisis that could result in time off and somebody really, the communication breaking down. The earlier that you can talk about somebody feeling stressed, unhappy, overwhelmed, unsupported, the earlier that you can talk about that, the more likely you can put the right things into place to stop that escalating into something that, that you know, is going to become a breakdown in the relationship.
Let's talk about online media, finally. And BuzzFeed have bought HuffPo from their parent company, Verizon, with Verizon now getting a seat on BuzzFeed's board. Steve, the two companies are keeping their brands separate, aren't they? So you're still going to visit Huffington Post separately from BuzzFeed. And the two brands with a lot of heritage, of course. But they're also two brands that have struggled to get traction in recent years, with Facebook changing their algorithms, as we were talking about before. Do you think they can work better together behind the scenes?
I think we can look at history in terms of media mergers, you know, regardless of platform, and see they're littered with a lot more failures, unfortunately, than successes. And particularly when you've got two brands, as you say, that are struggling, that maybe have had better days. Whether you merge two to make one bigger one, it doesn't necessarily mean that the product's still going to work. So I've got my doubts, really, in terms of whether for companies like this, the sort of moment has been and gone in terms of the relevance they can have to sort of people and their lives and how they consume information.
I mean, Caroline, the New York Times lists this merger as the fourth significant merger among name brand digital publishers. So they have the combination of Vox and New York Magazine, then Vice's acquisition of Refinery 29, then Group 9's merger with PopSugar, as three others that have happened this year. Why is there so much of this consolidation going on in this space?
I think it has a lot to do with, as you say, the Facebook algorithm change. In general, the sense that there's a limited number of eyeballs out there, and therefore you to have a better idea of to have a better chance of capturing them, you need to have as many different facets to your brand as possible. And what's an easy way to do that? To just acquire a pre-existing one and ideally acquire that audience with it. And I think that's what we've seen. I think the Vice Refinery 29 one is a really good example of that. Refinery 29 was primarily a brand aimed at millennial women, not something, you know, people that do read Vice, but not in as great a numbers as they read Refinery 29.
Deborah, have these companies just got a bit bloated? I mean, you know, they started as kind of agile startups being online only to say, ha-ha, look at you, old world media with your expensive printing presses and your staff are old journalists. You know, we'll do things a different way. And now they've just become American corporations that hire loads and loads of people and have big buildings. And actually, companies like the New York Times have got a very good online offer now that they're competing with.
Well, it's kind of the problem with VC investment, really, across the board. So I think that was partly what was behind Vice's, bringing together with a refinery, was, the need to grow exponentially to give investors back at least 10 times on their investment. And so you need to, the easiest way to grow is to add your company to somebody else's company, and now suddenly you're double the company with all the more eyeballs and all the more opportunities for brand and advertising revenue. So I think that's what's behind these companies feeling the need to grow so quickly and needing these partnerships to do that.
But also, Steve, the numbers are completely bewildering, aren't they? I'm going to read this out. I had to read it twice to make sure it was true because it just sounds absolutely ridiculous. Verizon in 2015 bought HuffPo for $4.4 billion, then combined it with Yahoo, which it acquired not in kind of 2010, but in 2017 for $4.5 billion. And in 2018, a year later, wrote down the value of its media assets by $4.6 billion to $200 million. I mean, I don't understand how that's possible to make such a serious error.
You would have thought someone has lost a job somewhere over that.
I mean,
strategically, it just seems astonishing, really. What it really suggests, I think, and I know nothing about their operation, but you would have thought, just looking in from the outside, what it suggests is an organization that's sort of trying to find a strategy that's applicable for where the world is now and really struggling.
And it was, I mean, you talked about the history of mergers, which obviously we've tracked on this show as well, but some of the names come up again and again. I mean, I don't remember anyone ever having a good experience buying AOL or Yahoo. So why do they keep doing it?
Well, Yahoo especially just seems amazing, doesn't it? It was such an ongoing story for such a long time in terms of a failing brand. And yet, as you say, it kept sort of bubbling up and being acquired, and then someone else would give it a go and it would be acquired again, and ridiculous amounts being floated around for some of the people involved there. So it does seem astonishing, but I suppose it says a wider thing just about where media as a whole is now, which is, you know, the huge competition that is going on for eyes and ears, and it can come from so many different sources. And so what you found is, whereas, even 5 years ago, we were far more siloed than we are now in terms of the sorts of companies making the sorts of content, everything is merging at a much faster speed now, where just because you were traditionally a TV producer, you might now be an audio producer as well. Or just because traditionally you were a newspaper owner, you might now be a radio owner. All these things are sort of coming together. And I think it's leaving a number of companies sort of questioning what their place in the marketplace is.
Yeah, and the audience are being pretty flexible on that as well, aren't they, Caroline? They're happy to get, in your world, they're happy to find a podcast that comes from a newspaper or a blog or an independent or the BBC and just assess it on its own merits.
I don't think people really make a distinction at all, no. And this is actually something that's come up quite a bit in relation to the BBC's offering with audio and its attempts to woo back young people who have sort of left the corporation in favour of things like Netflix and Spotify. I think the BBC is placing a lot of emphasis on, like, what is a music stream and what is a podcast and so on. And I'm just not sure that the people trying to consume it really bother trying to distinguish. And I think that's the same in how increasingly a lot of people consume things.
Although I suppose the way that ends, though, Deborah, is let's take podcasts for example, because that's what we're talking about. If you've got an absolute killer true crime series and everyone wants it, you know, there's a bidding war, The Telegraph want it and Audible want it, the final destination for that is that you no longer have any sense of brands that are putting things out, because it could just as equally have come from any of them.
Yeah, is that so different? As to before, like, you know, Bake Off went from BBC One to Channel 4. I think that's always what has happened. Talent has been poached from one provider, from another provider. And it's up to those platforms who want to remain at the top to make sure that they get the best talent, or they nurture it from early on. Like, the best thing that the BBC could be doing is nurturing young talent, you know, from the womb, basically, as early as possible. Get those people in and be making sure that you are nurturing them, and that you're not just trying to poach people once they're already successful, which is a much higher price game.
And not getting reality stars to host radio shows, Steve.
Well, don't start me about reality stars hosting radio shows. So,
oh, good. I'm glad I touched enough. I wasn't sure if you produced any of those. So no. I was treading carefully.
No, we don't. I have a viewpoint on you know, I'm not sure that is the sort of content the BBC should be doing. But anyway, that's another story for another time. The one thing I was going to say was, you know, I do agree in terms of audiences. Obviously, we'll just search out great content. I think there are a small number of exceptions to that where companies are able to build themselves as a brand and become a sort of kite mark of quality. So when you think about HBO or you think about Wondery, I think, you know, you know, those companies have been able to build themselves to a level where when you see it's an HBO show, you think, okay, you know, it's probably really good because I know all those other HBO shows I've seen. And obviously the same with Wondery and what they've done as well. But for the majority of companies and platforms, yeah, I don't think it matters. The audience just want great stories and great content, and it doesn't matter who's making it.
You will be pleased to know, all of you, that there is just time for our legendary media podcast quiz. This week it is entitled Uncanny. I'm going to impersonate three people in the media glare this week. You will tell me who I'm evoking and what the story is.
Ollie, are you sure this is a good idea?
Is this where it all ends? If you've got this far in the podcast, we're all friends. Buzzing with your name when you know the answer. So Steve, you will say...
Steve.
Caroline, you'll say...
Caroline.
And Deborah, you will say?
Deborah.
Best of three. Here we go. Buzzing with your name when you know the answer. Who said, I hope my voice comes back in time for the first show, as I can no longer simply rely on a fake tan and a fringe. There's nobody Deborah. I'd rather be with at the weekend. Is it Deborah?
Winkleman.
It just known by the surname. For a half bonus point, the full name, please.
Oh, do you know why I said Winkleman? As I completely forgot her first name, which is terrible. Isn't that awful?
Claudia Winkleman.
Claudia, that's it, yeah.
Yes, who is to take over from Graham Norton on Radio 2 in February. Good choice, bad choice?
Good choice.
Good choice.
Steve, good choice, bad choice?
Good choice.
Caroline, good choice, bad choice?
Great choice.
I have to agree, that's a clean set. Well done, Claudia. She's been waiting 12 years to get a decent slot, though. okay, here is impersonation number two. Who is this? As with other TV productions, Netflix should be very clear at the beginning. It is just fiction. Without the Caroline.
I love your voice. Is that Gillian Anderson doing Thatcher?
I'm going to carry on. That's a good
Steve,
guess.
Okay.
It's the right story. Steve, yes.
I think it's Oliver Dowden.
It is Oliver Dowden, the culture minister, sounding uncannily like departed royal correspondent James Whittaker in my impersonation. and what was he talking about?
Well, the most ridiculous news story probably of the week about the Crown should have a warning before its episode saying that it's fiction, you know, something that Oliver Dowden and the Daily Mail seem to have got very exercised about, mainly because I think if you see the new season of the Crown, Prince Charles is not portrayed very well. So, yeah.
That is the story, and well stolen from Caroline. And here is impersonation number three. Who am I? The days are over it to give a you exposure are over. What exposure? For someone interrupt this accent. For what? We won't get any gigs these days. They want us and our expertise, but they won't pay for it. Caroline, say your name. Caroline.
I'm afraid I can't remember the name, but is this the musician that strictly refused to pay to play on the show?
It is, yes. Anyone for a bonus point know their name? The band that were... not taken to play on Strictly It Takes Two. If I tell you, will someone say it back? They were called Amaratera.
Were they called Amaratera? Amaratera?
Yes, Ollie? They were, Caroline, which means you win the quiz. Well done. I don't know how you got that extra point. Incredible. they were given an offer to go on the BBC Strictly show It Takes Two in return for a free lunch and the exposure. A BBC spokesperson later said that payment would have been given had the performance gone ahead. You weren't surprised by that story at all, were you, Deborah? But it is kind of shocking, isn't it? Big show, that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame. I mean, it's pretty frowned upon now. I must belong to at least two WhatsApp groups of women in media talking about all the things they get asked to do for free or cheap. So this is something now that unfortunately people can't really get away with anymore, and I need to start thinking about how best they can incentivize people in a very fair way.
Except here on the Media Podcast, of course, where all four of us have been incredibly well remunerated for our services this afternoon. Caroline, you had your hand up. What was it you wanted to say?
I was just interested in, to clarify, that response from the BBC, they said they would have been paid, but they just hadn't mentioned it. It hadn't come up.
I wouldn't be surprised. This is just based on my experience as talent, and I am doing air quotes, which you can't see, is that sometimes you're told by a producer, come on the show for no money, because the producer's been told they have no money. But then someone in a BBC accounts department somewhere who no one's ever met then gets in touch with you subsequently and says, oh, the rate for this show is this, and sends you a check in the post. That still happens. You're nodding, Steve. It sometimes seems that people even running the own shows don't seem to know what the budget of the show is.
Well, I'm nodding only actually in terms of, to me, I mean, it does seem extraordinary that in this day and age, anybody would be saying to anybody, come and do something for sort of free, you know, particularly when they've got an expertise, i.e. a musician, and especially, you know, big or small production. I mean, I kind of get it if you're pulling a few favours with a few mates because you're making a podcast out of your bedroom or something. But I don't think I quite get it with a programme of that scale.
We're, of course, making a podcast out of your respective bedrooms, which is even lonelier. But it's been a fascinating show. Thank you very much. Congratulations, Caroline, for winning the quiz. And thank you to Caroline Crampton, to Steve Ackerman, and to Deborah Coughlin. Give your colleagues the gift of insight and analysis this Christmas by telling them all about our show. There is a handy link in our show notes, which you can use to share it, even if they've never heard a podcast before. Do it now. I've been Ollie Mann. The Media Podcast is a PPM and Rethink Audio production, produced this week by Matt Hill and Penny Bell. Until next time, bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.